Thank you, Ron. And I'd also like to say thank you to the Cowan Foundation for supporting me in the writing of this research paper. And I'd like to thank Special Collections, particularly Lee Hayes and Cheryl Hoskin. And thank you to Paul Wilkins for organising this event. And I'd also like to acknowledge that Nancy's son, Jonathan Cook, is here today, and he's going to come up a bit later and tell you some of his memories of his mother towards the end of my talk, and then you can put some questions to both of us. So Nancy Atkinson's papers were donated by Jonathan in 1999, in the year of her death, and I only discovered them in 2015, so they've been sitting there for a long time. And I was immediately interested in her and in bringing her story to light. So to provide some context, it wasn't until a few decades, to the last few decades of last century, that women writers began to undertake research into women's contributions to science in Australia, both in industry and academia, particularly during World War II and in the immediate post-war years. The books and articles produced from this time have sought to acknowledge and highlight the achievements of these women and to understand how they managed to pursue and negotiate careers in traditionally male-dominated fields. As Farley Kelly, the leading writer in this field, argues, multiple factors conspired to have women fall off the rungs of the career ladder in science. And the marginalised status of women is expressed through recurring adjectives in these works, such as excluded, obliterated, unacknowledged, unrecognised, invisible. Many who went on to marry are frequently described as casualties because in most cases they had to forgo their career as resignation on the date of their marriage was a requirement of women in any public service institution until 1966, and certainly an expectation in other places of work. In fact, one academic even ventured to suggest that it was freakish for a woman to continue work after marriage. Yet there were a few exceptions, and one of them is Nancy Atkinson. A graduate of Melbourne University, Atkinson was appointed lecturer in charge of the Department of Bacteriology at the University of Adelaide in 1942, and at the time she was in her early 30s, and she was promoted to reader in charge less than a decade later. And despite two marriages and a son, she her career kept on track, and in Irresistible Forces, Australian Women in Science, which is a key work in this field, Claire Hooker acknowledges that bacteriological research in Adelaide was entirely supported by Nancy Atkinson, and that when she was appointed reader in microbiology at the University of Adelaide, it made her the first woman at the university to gain such seniority. So that she's not more well-known or more written about has surprised me, but it's also confirmed for me the value of researching and writing about her achievements. And the people certainly at ANU who work on the Australian Journal of Biography were very pleased to receive my essay, partly because they have so few essays, they said, unfortunately, on women scientists. That she hasn't received much recognition or due recognition may be partly explained by the fact that she was thwarted at the last rung of the career ladder when she did not get the chair of microbiology at the University of Adelaide in 1958. Furthermore, enforced retirement on her 65th birthday led her to embark on a new career as a winemaker under her married name, Benko. And this, therefore, perhaps served to obscure her identity as Nancy Atkinson. So it's my pleasure to bring her story to light. So I've just put some key dates here on the slides, so hopefully my talk will coincide with those dates. So she was born in Melbourne on March the 9th, 1910, and grew up in St Kilda. She was the only child of Stella Charlotte and Ralph Arthur Atkinson, and her father was managing director of a stationery company, Newell & Co. She was an innately studious child, who was forbidden to do homework, according to Jonathan, because it overstimulated her mind and prevented her from sleeping. She excelled at school. And Jonathan also describes her as a genius, as an all-round person who had a gift for languages and for mathematics. She was educated at Oberwool, a progressive private girls' school, a boarding school in St Kilda, which offered Latin, Greek and mathematics, as well as the usual subjects. The granddaughters of Charles Dickens, Violet and Kathleen Dickens, attended this school, and also Joan Lindsay, who wrote Picnic at Hanging Rock, and purportedly Margaret Preston, the Australian artist. It was known for its elegance and French culture. Established in 1867 by Madame Elise Fund, a Swiss art patron, whose portrait was painted by Tom Roberts, and this hangs in the National Gallery of Australia, I think, in Portrait Gallery, yes, in Canberra. And in fact, I think he did several portraits of her. And the school was later purchased by two sisters from France, and they also founded the Alliance Française Prize in Melbourne. And in 1925, Atkinson was Dux of the school, and before that, in leaving, she won the Alliance Française Prize for French composition. And Jonathan's brought that prize along for you to have a look at among the exhibits today. And newspaper articles tracking her career suggest that she continued with French, and that she also studied German, reading scientific articles published in both languages. I'm just going to show you a picture. This is Oberwall in 2004. And in 2016, I think it was up for sale. It's a beautiful old building. So if you look it up online, you might be able to, it shows you inside as well. Atkinson's parents were supportive of her decision to go to university. And Jonathan thinks that she won a scholarship as well to the school. She began a science degree at the University of Melbourne in the late 1920s, majoring in chemistry before transferring to bacteriology. I haven't been able to find out whether they offered chemistry at her school, but most girls' schools didn't offer physics and chem. So she may have had to have done some extra night classes. Certainly some of the graduates, science graduates at the University of Adelaide had to go to Adelaide Boys High to do some to learn about chemistry and physics to catch up. But she transferred to bacteriology, and at the time a number of new disciplines were emerging in the biological sciences, and Atkinson entered the University of Melbourne at a unique time for women, whose access to science was helped by the fact that the scientific community was small and up until World War II was not highly regarded in Australia, or as highly as it was in Europe and in the US. Other factors also contributed, the emergence of research institutes in the major states of Australia, initially in Melbourne with the opening of the Walter and Eliza Hall Research Institute in 1915, and soon afterwards in Sydney and Adelaide, as well as the growth of medical specialisation, created employment opportunities. And in fact, a number of jobs were advertised just for women, particularly research positions and demonstrator positions, and there are also quite a few grants available too. The war consolidated women's place in the scientific community, and furthermore, as Jane Carey notes, women were not unilaterally pushed out of their jobs at war's end. Anne Moyle, another key figure in this field, attributes the significant movement of women in science in the early 1900s to motivation, confidence, and opportunities to pursue a career in research, and to the fact that there was a niche position captured by women, notably in Melbourne, in the young discipline of microbiology. Many of the women who graduated in the biological sciences from the University of Melbourne in the 1930s, around the time that Atkinson graduated, went on to have distinguished careers in bacteriology, holding senior positions in universities and major hospitals. And in my essay, I've expanded on that, but I've had to cut out some things here. When she graduated BSc in 1930, Atkinson became one of the first two students in the country to major in bacteriology. The University of Melbourne was the first university in the country to offer bacteriology as a major in a subject in a science degree. She graduated MSc a year later. This was also the year in which, at the age of 52, and when Atkinson was 22, her father died of pneumonia. She always lamented the fact that he died too early for penicillin to save him. His death occurred only a decade before the first civilian, Anne Sheaf Miller, was successfully treated with penicillin after she contracted an infection following a miscarriage. And there's another story of a very well-known young microbiologist from the University of Melbourne that Nancy Atkinson would most certainly have known, who graduated a couple of years after her, and she died after an accident in the lab where she accidentally inoculated herself with a very severe strain of typhus, and she died. So I tell a little bit more about her in my essay. So in 1932, supported by a grant, she worked as a research scholar in the Department of Bacteriology, investigating pollution in the waters of Port Phillip Bay and the public's immunity to typhoid and paratyphoid, which inspired an abiding interest in water bacteriology. From 1933 to 37, she worked in the department as a demonstrator in Bacteriology 1 and Medical Bacteriology, and gave practical lectures in Bacteriology 2. And in 1937, she moved to Adelaide after being appointed assistant bacteriologist to Professor Albert Edward Blatt at the South Australian Government Laboratory of Pathology and Bacteriology, which was incorporated into the Institute of Medical and Veterinary Science, referred to as the IMVS, in the following year. And her appointment was announced in the news in May 1937, in which it was explained that her exceptionally high qualifications had given her an advantage over other applicants. And this is the photograph that was in the paper when she got that position. So a number of things facilitated her career, and the fact that she was in this new science was one of them. The IMVS undertook research in clinical medicine and also offered teaching and laboratory services. It was situated in the grounds of the Adelaide Hospital, and it was an extension of the facilities already provided at the hospital for research into human and animal pathology, bacteriology and biochemistry, and it collaborated closely with both the university and the hospital. And Nancy Atkinson's work at the Institute was primarily in the field of medical microbiology, specifically research into the public's immunity to viruses such as influenza, mumps, measles and infantile paralysis, typhoid and typhus fever. And this was in keeping with her previous experience in Melbourne, where she'd conducted routine tests for the Victorian Department for Public Health. So every year, tens of thousands of routine tests were carried out for the Royal Adelaide Hospital, for other hospitals in the state, both public and private, and for medical and veterinary practices. In 1939, while still employed at the IMVS, Atkinson began working as a part-time lecturer at the University of Adelaide, and she continued to work concurrently at the IMVS and the university until 1949. Until 1950, it was possible to hold joint appointments at these institutions. At the university, a new department of bacteriology was being developed, and Edward Albert Platt, who she also worked under at the IMVS, he'd designed a bacteriology course when he first joined the university in 1936, as lecturer of bacteriology in the Department of Pathology in the medical faculty. And he drafted a syllabus for the more advanced subject of bacteriology too. But this was not offered until 1939, the year in which an independent chair and department were created and housed in the new laboratories, which had just opened at the IMVS. You'll see here that there's mention of my grandmother as well. Like Nancy, was one of the first bacteriology students at the University of Melbourne. My grandmother was one of the first graduates in bacteriology here, and worked as Nancy Atkinson's sole assistant in 1939 and continued to work with her throughout the war at both the university and the IMVS. So in July 1939, Platt went abroad, and he didn't return until September 1940. And during his absence, Atkinson took over his roles, as she became both acting head of the department at the university and bacteriologist in charge at the IMVS. And then in September 1941, Platt resigned to take up a position as acting director of the Department of Pathology at Prince Henry Hospital in Sydney. And on his resignation, Atkinson, on his recommendation too, was appointed acting head of the department and at both the IMVS and also at the university. So after Platt left, Nancy Atkinson was kept very busy teaching bacteriology, and she was teaching across four disciplines because it was taught in science and medicine, and also in agricultural science and in dentistry. It was traditionally considered a medical subject, but Nancy Atkinson felt very strongly that it belonged more properly to science And from 1945, she designed courses to suit the different disciplines of both at both undergraduate and postgraduate level, so in pharmacy, dentistry, ag science, and later for industrialists and engineers. In 1942, she also married Irving MacDonald Cook, and her marriage apparently having no effect on her career, as it coincided with her joint appointments at the IMVS and at the university. She'd met Irving Cook, whom she married in Adelaide at St John's Church, Halifax, on January the 24th, 1942. She'd met him at a tennis group. She always liked physical exercise and played a lot of sport. Cook had put himself through architecture, and after graduating in 1931, he'd been unable to find a job. And as a child, he'd helped run his father's cinema business. And when Atkinson met him, he was going around Victoria screening 16mm films in town halls. And after 3 years on the road, he became the South Australian manager of British Empire Films. And I've managed to find a photograph of him. It's up here on this table here. In a newspaper article a few years later, Atkinson was described as belonging to that relatively small group of women who've proved themselves capable of combining two careers successfully. The two careers referred to were her work as an academic and her role as Mrs. Irving Cook, first-rate cook and housekeeper. So as reflected in this comment, and as Claire Hooker notes, for women, matrimony was regarded as a profession in itself. But while marriage could have ended her career, as it had and would for so many other women, it didn't for Atkinson. And undoubtedly it helped that Cook was supportive of her career. In an interview on April 29th, 1946, she said, "My husband is quite willing for me to continue my work here." So while teaching and administrative duties took up much of her time at the university, she was kept busy with routine testing and research at the IMVS. The research work, which was largely funded by annual grants for salaries, was focused on antibiotics, salmonellas and other groups of bacteria, bacteriophage and dairy bacteriology, as well as vaccines for tuberculosis and typhoid. On a small scale, in collaboration with medical practitioner Darcy Cowan, who was the first appointed physician to the chest clinic at the Royal Adelaide Hospital and founder of the South Australian Tuberculosis Association in 1943, and who later founded Bedford Industries, she prepared a BCG vaccine, which was aimed at preventing TB. And in the 1940s, the IMVS was the only laboratory producing this vaccine in Australia and carrying out research in this field. It was not a cure-all. It was designed as a preventative, and the ultimate aim was to mass-produce it to make it available to all Australians. And they treated batches of volunteers and did have some success in suppressing TB infections, but funding was withdrawn by the federal government in 1949 and the research discontinued. But Nancy Atkinson had plenty of other projects she was overseeing. As pointed out by microbiologist and virologist Frank Fenner, during World War II, in Australia as in other combatant countries, much civilian research was focused on the war effort, and the IMVS was no exception to that. Nancy Atkinson and her team worked on antibacterial substances from penicillin mould to help in the prevention of bacteria in war wounds, and they also carried out research into gastrointestinal infections and food poisoning, not only in troops but also in the general public. Atkinson trained medical students to work for the pathology department of the Army Medical Corps and coordinated a course preparing bacteriologists to work in military hospitals where they would advise doctors in their diagnoses. Research was also carried out into influenza in anticipation of another flu epidemic like that experienced in World War I. Many scientists were working on developing vaccines, including my grandmother, Jessica Mawson, younger daughter of Mawson, as I mentioned before. And this is her in the lab. She went to Melbourne, and Macfarlane Burnet had pioneered a method of inoculating chick embryos with directly from humans with the flu virus. And this is my grandmother doing that here in the lab. And, yeah, like Nancy Atkinson had transferred, as I mentioned before, from chemistry to bacteriology, and my grandmother also transferred. She was initially interested in botany, but then it was actually Mawson who discovered that there was a new course here at the university in bacteriology, and he recommended that to my grandmother. And no offence to botanists, if there are any here, but he went to the Waite Institute and saw a whole lot of students in a glass house counting leaves. And when he found out they were botanists, he thought that was not so interesting and that it might be better to take up bacteriology. And my grandmother, in 1942, she became the first person in South Australia to isolate an influenza virus strain under Nancy Atkinson's supervision there at the IMVS, using this technique. The then director of the IMVS was Englishman Edward Weston Hurst, and he was well known for his research in neuropathology and virus diseases. And it was Hurst who inspired Nancy Atkinson's interest in antibiotics and early research into antibiotics in molds. And her investigations led to the isolation of a new antibiotic, penicillin, which turned out to be identical to several other mold antibiotics discovered in England and the United States at around the same time. Claviformin was the first mold antibiotic to be characterised, and Atkinson's penicillin was identified with claviformin by Howard Florey, who took samples of her penicillin crystals to England for analysis after a visit to Adelaide in 1944. However, Nancy Atkinson did not undertake further research into mold antibiotics, judging that the field seemed already overcrowded. But it was Florey, again, who encouraged Atkinson to undertake research into antibacterial substances in fungi, arguing that she was in a unique position to undertake such a study at the University of Adelaide, because Professor John Cleland, who was Professor of Pathology from 1920 to 1948, whose daughter Joan Cleland, later Peyton, who was a contemporary and good friend of my grandmother's, was the first appointed biochemist at the IMVS. So Professor Cleland was an authority on classifying fungi, and he agreed to not only help Atkinson with identification but also with the collection of fungi on excursions into the Adelaide Hills. And they also put appeals in the paper for plant and fungi samples, and so members of the public would scour their gardens and the city parklands for specimens, and they delivered these to the gates of the Institute on Frome Road. Toadstools and mushrooms, as well as hundreds of kinds of flowering plants, were also obtained from the garden of botanical artist and plant collector Alison Ashby, and they were collected and tested. And they had some success, particularly with Geraldton wax and Lepidium, which showed the most promising results. Most, contained antibacterial substances that were also only active against the same diseases as penicillin. But they did have success, particularly in terms of fungi, with a rare edible mushroom called Celiota xanthoderma. Please correct me if it's wrong. This proved effective in killing in the test tube a wide range of disease germs unaffected by penicillin, including typhoid and tuberculosis germs. And additionally, they hadn't required resistance, unlike in the case of penicillin and streptomycin, to which germs were increasingly becoming resistant even then. And Atkinson's research later expanded to include testing of dried plant specimens obtained from Northern Australia and New Guinea, and the investigation of antibacterial substances in essential oils from native plants, a field in which little had been published. And at the same time, as if she didn't have enough to do, she pursued her research into salmonellas. This interest had begun when she was working at the University of Melbourne, and the senior lecturer, Thomas Green Gregory, had got her to make some salmonella antisera. And she'd taken this salmonella to Adelaide and later sourced samples from other institutes. And in the 1940s and 50s, her focus was on identifying strains of salmonella gastroenteritis in Australia, outbreaks of which in the first half of the 20th century were extremely common and sometimes life-threatening. Little research had been done on humans as carriers, however, because it was thought that animals were the primary source of food poisoning. Research was carried out at a salmonella typing laboratory, and this was the first of its kind in the country, and only one of only three in the world. The other two were in Copenhagen and in London, capable of describing serotypes of this disease. And many new ones were described, the most well-known being Salmonella Adelaide, which was first isolated in 1943 from a fatal case of enteritis. And the laboratory also sourced Salmonella cultures from all over Australia, including from army hospitals, as there are frequent outbreaks among troops. This is an image of Nancy in the paper with Jonathan. And in ABC radio interviews, in articles for popular magazines and in talks to local societies such as church groups, rotary clubs and public libraries, Atkinson educated and advised the public about the dangers of pathogenic bacteria. So one thing that I did notice was that, you know, she, of course, published in all the major journals, particularly the Medical Journal of Australia, but also in more popular publications and was regularly on the radio because she was passionate about educating people about the importance of their health. And she warned that tuberculosis, a common disease in cows, could be contracted through drinking milk. If the cow was suffering from mastitis, it could introduce bacteria into the milk, which could lead to a number of other diseases, including diphtheria, scarlet fever, typhoid, acute gastroenteritis, or septic sore throat. And she feared a milk-borne epidemic as a result of unpasteurised milk. And in the mid-1940s, she carried out tests for the Metropolitan Board of South Australia on the quality of milk, cream and ice cream to assess their suitability for human consumption. And she also tested penicillin on cows suffering from mastitis with really miraculous results. She found that they only needed a fraction of what was needed for a human, and quite often the cow had to be destroyed if it suffered from mastitis, so this was important. And her research led to the standardisation of the production, sale, storage and delivery of milk in South Australia. So, as you can see from this picture, her son Jonathan was born in 1948, and just as neither a divorce nor a second marriage had... I haven't mentioned the second marriage yet. Having a child proved no obstacle to her, and before Jonathan was a year old, she returned to work and soon afterwards embarked on a research trip. She'd been granted leave of absence from the university to travel to the US, Britain and Denmark over the summer vacation of 1949 to 50. And she visited the medical school at Stanford University, where she'd been invited as an exchange visitor to work with geneticist Joshua Lederberg on the immunogenetics of salmonellas. Lederberg was a pioneer in bacterial genetics, and in 1958, he won the Nobel Prize for his discovery of the mechanisms of genetic recombination in bacteria. And also included in her research program was a study of the latest developments in polio research, which involved visiting research institutes as well as university departments to investigate teaching methods. In June 1950, a polio research laboratory had been opened at the medical school here in the university, where, under the charge of Atkinson and funded by a government grant, tests were carried out on patients suffering from a polio epidemic, which occurred in the late 1940s in the first cases of polio in Australia. And having carried out research into milk-borne diseases and how to safeguard against them since the early 1940s, she also visited dairy farms in New York State and California to observe milk standards, and she was impressed with what she saw in the US and Britain, where even small farms were equipped with coolers and where milk was bottled before it was pasteurised. And this, actually, I found this picture online. It's Joshua Lederberg's wife's, her website. And so this is a picture of her in 1957. She was made OBE in 1951 for her contributions to public health. And in 1952, she divorced. So I kind of gave you a mention earlier about that. But she divorced Irving Cook, and they both remarried in 1952. Atkinson to Hungarian-born Andrew Benko. And like Cook, he trained as an architect and had obtained his doctorate in Milan, a practicing architect and town planner. he was, Jonathan remembers, also highly academic and therefore a good match with Atkinson. And the Benkos shared an appreciation for art and classical music and enjoyed playing golf and tennis and annual trips to the Victorian snowfields. And Jonathan might tell you a bit about those adventures because he sometimes went with them a bit later. 1952 was also the year that Atkinson was appointed reader in charge of the Department of Bacteriology. And at the time she was also working towards her DSC, which she'd begun in 1951 and which she qualified for with distinction in 1957. And this was based on her research on plants and fungi during the war and immediate post-war years, and also her research into salmonellas while she was working as head of both the IMVS and the Department of Bacteriology at the university. And then in the summer of 1958, at arguably the height of her career, she applied for the newly created Chair of Microbiology at the University of Adelaide. And when summarising her work in the department in her application, she pointed out that she'd sacrificed her own research work to build a school of microbiology and that her decision to do this had been critical in the development of microbiology in the university, adding that had she not developed science courses, microbiology would have been relegated to one or two applied courses. And throughout her years in the department, she'd campaigned tirelessly for more staff and teaching space and more equipment and maintenance of equipment to accommodate growing numbers of students. She claimed that it was not until 1950 when her responsibilities at the IMVS ended and she was appointed full-time at the university as reader in charge of the Department of Bacteriology that she found the time to devote to her own research. Interestingly, in an interview soon after her appointment as lecturer in bacteriology at the university in 1939, at the beginning of her career here at the university, and when she was running the department while Platt was on leave, she was quoted as saying, "I feel that I have a great opportunity at the university in taking over the work of the professor, although I realise that it does not fall to a woman's lot to hold the professor's chair." But by 1958, she'd changed her mind about this, and as indicated in her bid for the newly created chair of microbiology, she clearly indicates that she believed she had by then long since qualified for the role, having carried out, as she put it, all the functions of a professor of microbiology for years, despite her status remaining at lecturer. The department, she argued, had been developed entirely by her own personal efforts, for while Platt had laid the foundations, he'd been absent for 15 months of the 2 years and 9 months that he was professor. And it must have been a bit annoying because in year after year in the university calendar, it has the staff of the bacteriology department has professor colon blank, and then it has reader in charge, Nancy Atkinson, as if somehow there was someone above her, and there wasn't. She was really running it, as she said, fulfilling all the functions of a professor. However, senior lectureships, notes Anne Moyle, with the exceptional woman's glass ceiling, and this proved true for Atkinson, who did not get further than the shortlist. The position was offered to microbiologist and immunologist Derek Rowley, who I'm sure many of you have heard of, and he had worked with Alexander Fleming at the Glaxo Laboratories in London. Despite conceding that Rowley was a good appointment, former students of Nancy's recall that there was a general sense in the university that Atkinson should have got the chair, and that she was certainly deeply disappointed not to get the position. The reasons why she was not successful are not clear, but probably multiple. Jonathan suspects that it was because his mother didn't have a medical degree. Rowley did. There's also the fact that Rowley was British, which very likely worked in his favour. In a similar case, Dr. Wilfred Agar had been offered the chair of biology at the University of Melbourne in 1919 over Dr. Georgina Sweet, a leading Australian parasitologist who, like Atkinson, had been in charge of the bacteriology department in Adelaide for almost two decades. When Rowley was appointed chair, Sweet had more or less run the biology department very successfully for years in Melbourne. Like Rowley, Agar was British, and as Claire Hooker argues, he was chosen for this reason, because Britain was seen as the centre of research. Her gender was also very likely a contributing factor, as in Sweet's case as well. Certainly other women academics had missed out on chairs because of sexual bias, most notably Ethel McClellan, Sweet's protégé. who was unsuccessful in her bid for the chair of botany at the University of Melbourne in 1913, despite an international reputation for her research in mycology, plant fungi, and extensive teaching experience. The then professor of botany, Alfred Ewart, later admitted that he'd not recommended her simply due to the fact that she was a woman. So it's tempting to ask, would a man in Atkinson's position and with her credentials have been so quickly overlooked? As it turns out, it was not until 1978, 2 decades after Nancy Atkinson's application for the chair of microbiology, and 3 years after her retirement, that the first woman chair was appointed here at the University of Adelaide, Faye Gale, in geography. But however, Nancy Atkinson continued to be just as dedicated to her work, and it was around the time of her application for the chair of microbiology that she became involved in the formation of the Australian Society of Microbiology. And Frank Fenner says that it was largely due to the enthusiasm and drive of Nancy Atkinson at the University of Adelaide that an Australian Society of Microbiology was established. While in Adelaide for an Australian and New Zealand Association for the Advancement of Science Congress in 1958, Atkinson convened a meeting of about 50 scientists to discuss the idea of a society dedicated to the promotion and fostering of microbiology rather than to science in general. Atkinson was appointed to draft a constitution for the society along with 2 other people and was the first honorary treasurer from 1959 to 1962, and she served as president from 62 to 64 and later made an honorary life member. Incidentally, Rowley was on the governing body as a South Australian delegate from 1960 to 1961 when Atkinson was treasurer. Her legacy is regularly acknowledged by the society. Every annual scientific meeting is traditionally opened with the Nancy Atkinson Bell named in her honour. This is a photograph I found of her in the lab in 1959. I don't mean to diminish, you know, what she did, but I'm going to sort of jump a bit here. In 1967, she moved to the Department of Oral Biology, and because the teaching of microbiology to dental students was taken over by this department. And she remained in this department till to her retirement in 1975. Meanwhile, while still working full-time as an academic, she wrote 2 books on art under her married name, Benko. The first, Art and Artists of South Australia, was an A to Z of South Australian artists, galleries, schools and events. Atkinson was a private collector, and as she explains in her introduction, the book had developed out of a personal interest in South Australian art and artists and a desire to inspire greater appreciation of South Australian art. And influential people in the art world helped her to compile it. It was written under the guidance of artists Ruth Tuck and Ivor Francis and published in 1969 under the patronage of Latvian father and son Carlos and Andrus Lidoms, the directors of a gallery of modern art in Beaumont, Adelaide, where Atkinson had bought a number of her paintings and artwork. As the first book to cover the subject of South Australian art and artists, it was an invaluable resource for art dealers and collectors, particularly in the days before the internet, but it remains an important reference source, providing in some cases the only available biographical information on the artists listed. And we have a copy of that here on display. She also wrote a biography of David Boyd, figurative painter and potter, The Art of David Boyd. This was published in 1973, and it was the first biography of Boyd, brother of Arthur Boyd. And Andrew Benko designed the book and sourced the details for the illustrations, and Judith Wright wrote a foreword. And the Lidoms were again involved, the idea of the book having been suggested by Andrus Lidoms and the publication supported by Carl Lidoms. And we also have that a copy of that on display. A few years later, she wrote a biographical entry for the Australian Dictionary of Biography on English-born artist Gustav Barnes, who settled in Adelaide and later became artist and art supervisor to the Art Gallery of South Australia. Her interest in art was largely inspired by her architect husband, Andrew Benko, and she'd begun collecting art in the 1960s, and she and Andrew Benko would go to exhibitions and buy paintings by well-known artists, and they had some pretty important works by Pro Hart, David Hessling, Sidney Nolan, and Jonathan remembers even that there was an Antipodean head by Nolan in their bedroom. However, in the late 1970s, she had to sell one of her Pro Harts when her winery proved more expensive than she anticipated. So this was Chalk Hill Winery. So she'd bought some land in 1973, a couple of years before her retirement. She had to think ahead about what she was going to do after finishing work. She didn't want to leave the university, but it was important to keep busy. And she'd begun to make plans for this, knowing of her impending retirement. And among other things that she'd been doing at the university was that she'd helped to establish the Water and Wastewater Association and also the Australian Institute of Food and Science Technology. And this inspired an interest in winemaking, which, again, was another predominantly male domain. And I found an article that was published only last year that says that women in Australia, women winemakers represent just 10% of all winemakers. So Atkinson would have stood out even more, you know, 40 or so years ago. And also quite a big thing to be taking on in her 60s. So Chalk Hill was in McLaren Vale, and there were already some vines there and some almonds as well. And Andrew Benko designed the buildings, and he worked the cellar door. The winery was officially opened in 1983 by Darry Osborne of Darrenburg Winery. And Atkinson made a variety of wines: Riesling, Rosé, Vintage of Tawny Port, Shiraz, Cab Sauv, Mead and Sparkling Mead. And she won several prizes, bronze medals for her 1978 Rosé and Ruby Red Port. In the same year, silver medals for her Vintage Port and Muscat, and for several years running in the late 1970s, gold and silver medals for her Shiraz. The winery was open 7 days a week, and she and Andrew Benko would drive there every day. They didn't stay overnight. They'd come back to their home in North Adelaide. And Jonathan might tell you of some of the stories of the winery. They were both quite small people, and locals recall Atkinson sitting very low down in her red Volvo, and that she had to peer through the steering wheel, often wearing a beret, and her husband, at only 5'2", barely cleared the counter at the cellar door. And she's remembered with affection by Darry Osborne, who I had a nice chat to. By the time they sold the winery to the Harveys, who still own it today, they sold it in 1995 and have retained its name, Atkinson had begun to get dementia like her mother before her. Locals who'd been interested in buying the winery had been half promised it by her, and so they were a bit shocked when they drove past Chalk Hill and saw the sold sign on the road. But Andrew Benko had taken a shine to the Harveys and made a quick sale, and Atkinson had presumably forgotten any promises she'd made. I'm skipping a bit here, but a few years after she sold the winery, she died in 1999, and Andrew Benko had died 2 years before that, in 1997. And while she'd run Chalk Hill Winery for more than a decade and gained much pleasure from it and a measure of success, I think at heart she was an academic, and one wonders what she might have achieved had she not been forced to retire from the university. And even those students who had little to do with her described being aware that Nancy Atkinson was someone important in the university who was doing important research work. Certainly her dedication to science was indisputable, and this struck me when I came across a last will and testament in a box of her belongings held at Chalk Hill. It was dated October 29th, 1940. She was then 30 years old and new to Adelaide, not yet married, and Jonathan hadn't been born. In it, she bequeaths all her personal belongings to Jean Lockhart Sutherland, and Sutherland had graduated MSc in bacteriology in the same year as Atkinson at the University of Melbourne, and I gather they were probably in touch here because she worked at, I think it was Seymour here, for a few years as a science teacher. But most notably, she left all her real estate and money to the Institute of Medical and Veterinary Science to be used for the purpose of medical research. Thank you.